Hello, and welcome to the PC Gamer Show for November 8th, 2017. We're live after some technical difficulties.
Air quotes live.
Wes, you want to break down exactly kind of what went wrong in the sequence of events leading up to our now audio-only show?
Well, let's see. It was about 12:20 when James gets on Slack and says, show PC's not booting.
No.
That's not what you want to hear like 45 minutes before you start a podcast. So we came in, we tried to diagnose what was going on with the PC that we usually run the Twitch stream on. Figured out we got it to boot, but Windows was either corrupted, maybe like during Windows update, it got turned off and something happened. Something went wrong. Maybe the hard drives failed. I'm not sure. We tried to run startup repair a couple times. Did not work. So then we tried swapping out the hardware, the Elgato capture card that we used to capture video for the stream, to a different PC that was also belonged to our video team, except that PC was configured to be part of like the domain, company domain that has IT admins and all that stuff. And we don't have the same network and IT stuff set up anymore since we moved from our old office. So there was no one who knew the administration login info required to install OBS or anything on that computer. So fuck computers.
Yeah, computers are bad. 2017. That's the voice of Wes Fenlon, our features editor. Also with us is Blizzard Moore.
Hi, that's
our technology editor. That's Bo Moore.
How do you guys feel about just playing all games on consoles now? Fuck computers.
I think computers are bad. I think the graphics on consoles are good. I think
they're so much better.
Yeah.
There's really no comparison.
The mouse and the keyboard. What's up with that? Just kidding. We love computers. We're seeing some awful, awful. Oh no, people are very angry at us in chat. We're in the Discord right now for our club, our PC Gamer Club.
We're just fooling around.
We're just fooling around. Just kidding, you guys. We love computers. We love PC games. We love the good graphics.
Though I would rather use a console over a Windows PC that has administrator IT stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
bane of my existence.
We take the bad with the good with our chosen platform.
There's a reason all the computers that we use in our office for like our day-to-day work stuff are computers that I built.
Yeah.
It's so that we didn't have to have someone else maintain it.
It is the house that Wes built, our office. Anyway, let's get on to the show. We've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to start with Now Playing as usual. Bo is going to give us his recap of BlizzCon and all the cool announcements that came out of there.
Cool stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Call of Duty World War II, which I played and reviewed.
I played a lot of that game.
It was a very long 2 days.
Were you as good at the multiplayer as I was in my preview session? I got a lot of kills, James.
I mean, I was playing a lot. I went to a review event, and I also played a lot live. And I will say, at the review event, I was playing against QA testers. So I was like, I thought they would kick my ass, since that's like their job to play the game. Pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I was playing against QA too, and I would say consistently doing like 3-to-1 kill death ratio.
My suspicion is that they are all focused or primarily focused on
the console version.
But I'm, you know, I'm gonna
put a mouse in their hands. Yeah. And like, do I hold this upside down? How does this
I don't
work?
Know how this works. We're gonna talk about Call of Duty World War II, and then move into a nice long Q&A session. You guys gave us some good questions, and we're gonna, you know, power through those. But to start, what have we been playing? Have you guys been playing anything? There's a lot of games coming out, and you two are sort of notorious for never playing anything.
For not
playing games. Bo, you're the Overwatch guy. Wes, you're just like
rude.
The obtuse RPG guy.
I did play Legend Japanese of Heroes this year. That was a waste of time.
But anything, give me something here.
I've been playing more Stardew Valley.
All right. How's that going?
on the Switch,
no
you
less.
Traitor.
I know.
It's a good platform for it. I mean, you gotta admit, yeah, it's a great, portable game.
My death to PCs line was just a trap.
It really was.
It fell right into it.
It really was. No, I've been playing a fair bit of Stardew Valley, as right well on. As I fired up Nier Automata.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yesterday cool. to give it a shot. And it's a game that, like, by all accounts, I should love, and I am expecting to once I actually give it a shot and play mm-hmm. it. I did not get very far due to some PC technical difficulties of my own.
Okay, come on now. This is your TV, though,
this
right?
is my
don't,
TV. It
don't,
actually
don't blame it on the yeah, computer.
I won't
this time.
Blame the PC. Basically, my living room TV is hooked up to one of my home desktops, and I wanted to play this game on the couch with a controller rather than sit at my desk. It was cold in my apartment, and I wanted to be under a blanket, if
fair
I'm
enough.
Being perfectly honest. And but my TV has, basically, it's just a crappy TV that flickers on and off and will sometimes just freeze, and you have to reset it. And when you do that, if you're playing a full screen game, the game like freezes, and it was having resolution issues. It was just a whole deal. And for a game that does not have autosaves, I did not want to deal with potentially crashing at some random point. So
before I talk about what I've been playing, small tangent here. You mentioned it's been colder in San Francisco lately. You wanted to be huddled up under a blanket. So for the past, like, I want to say 6 months at least, I've thought, like, I haven't been sleeping very well most nights. And I've been thinking, like, am I just, like, have I hit an age where suddenly I sleep like shit?
Oh, no.
Is it, like, stress? What's going on? I think like 90% of it was just the temperature. It wasn't cold enough. It was too warm.
Yeah.
And I was like in this zone of putting like a blanket on, but then waking up in the middle of the night all hot, kicking it off. The past like 2 weeks, I have been sleeping really, really well because it's been like 15 degrees
the
colder.
Cold.
It's so nice.
Open up those windows, get your bones chilled up, and then, as Bo would, get a nice blanket wrapped around you and cozy up to your
hell game. Yeah. So I actually played a bunch of Nier this weekend as well. For anyone who's not paying attention to what time of year it is, game of the year.
Yeah, we're all revisiting some stuff.
Debates are coming real soon. And as James alluded to, I may not be great at keeping up with the new games throughout the year.
We basically realized if we're going to debate for these games that we think should be game of the year, we probably should
maybe
have played
should
them.
Play some of them. Yeah.
It's important.
So, yeah.
It's important.
So we're doing our due diligence and playing these games.
And most of the games I'd played this year did not come out this year. So I played probably about 8 hours or so of Nier over the weekend. You told me that I was probably at that amount of time was probably pretty far into like a run of that game.
Yes.
If you're not too familiar with Nier, you can actually complete the game like four or more times, and get kind of, you'll see different parts of the story unfold.
Yeah.
A lot of things will make sense as you play it multiple times. It's designed to be played multiple times. It's not just a like new game plus you get everything's harder, you know, type thing. So I'm pretty far through my first playthrough of that, I think. So I did play a good chunk of that. That's a weird game. There are things about it that I really love. I love just the feel of movement in that game. If you're playing it with a controller, you can hit the right trigger to do this kind of like dash forward move that then starts you running.
Right.
And that move just feels so good to cast. It has this very, like, I don't know, movement in that game is almost like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon-y, kind of, where you're just, like, kind of skating over the landscape, and you can do these ridiculous jump, dash, jump moves. And that's fairly common in a lot of games, right? But there's something about the way that they animated it, the way they put, like, a little bit of pause before you do the dash forward that feels this kind of, like, charging up your
tension and release.
Yeah, exactly. Kinda, yeah. Exactly. It just feels really, really fun to just move around in that game. The combat isn't like Bayonetta levels deep.
No, it's pretty simple.
But I actually find it really satisfying, and it has this really cool two weapon dynamic where you kind of you can have two weapons equipped at any time that you switch between. But even if you don't switch between them, you'll use both of them in like combo attacks. So I carry around like your katana, which is kind of your like default weapon. And then I bought this greatsword. Mm. And then so I have that as like my alt weapon. And when I do like a light, several light attacks and then a heavy attack, she'll pull out the greatsword for the heavy attack combo and like slam that down on the ground. So that's that feels really good. So that's a fun game. I'm going to try to finish a run through this weekend.
Has it made you feel any existential dread yet?
No.
Okay. You're not very far then. You're not very far then.
I mean, I did not feel dread at the robot orgy. No. I got that far.
I mean, I felt something else during that scene, but we'll save that for PC Gamer at Dark.
the other game that I played a bunch of this weekend, do you want to go over anything first and I can talk?
No, go for it, man. I'll just run through my list later.
So the other one is this roguelike called Unexplored, which has I've seen mentioned a few times. Waypoint has probably written about this game more than anybody else written or talked about it. There are a couple really good articles on Waypoint about what makes Unexplored such an interesting roguelike. But once you play it yourself, if you have any familiarity with Rogue or NetHack or any games in that sort of classical ASCII lineage, you'll immediately feel like the common elements of those games in Unexplored. But it has graphics. It has a very user-friendly interface where you can like drag and drop stuff out of your menu. It's very simple to equip items and tell what kind of item you have. Like it'll do the work for you of identifying something if you use it and its effect is obvious. It's like a big part of those games is if you throw a potion against a wall and it, you know, creates a fire explosion or something, then you know that was a fireball potion. I don't think that's an actual thing, but you know what I mean? If you use a teleport scroll and then you teleport somewhere, it will identify that scroll as a teleport scroll if you didn't know what it was. Lots of little touches like that. But the big twist of this game is it's real time instead of turn-based. Mm. In all those other games, you have as much time as you want to move one space or do one action, and in this game everything is real time. The enemies will come looking for you. You can pause it so you can still think through your moves, but it makes combat a totally different experience because you actually have to click on stuff to attack, and all the weapons have different like move animations. Like your default sword is kind of like a stabby piercing attack, but then you might pick up like a club or something that has a horizontal swing. So you have to totally change the way you move at enemies to account for that swing, and you have to read your distance and all that stuff. And it's hard to describe all the little touches that once you start playing it, you just go like, oh, this game feels really good. It's really smart the way they put it together. They managed to make that core concept a lot more approachable than a game like NetHack, where you have to kind of know what every key on the keyboard is going to do to go through a lot of actions, and keeping the interesting systemic interactions those games have without the bloat of a billion different systems. So it's definitely not as complex, but you can still mix potions together to create new ones. You can still write your own scrolls to learn magic. You still have to deal with cursed armor and equipment, and there's a lot to that game, and I would highly recommend it to anybody who likes roguelikes.
So that's Unexplored.
Unexplored.
It's like $10 on Steam.
$10.
It's a good deal then.
Yeah. And that includes like a couple DLC expansions too.
Oh shoot, really?
Yes. Okay. Two or three, I think.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really good visit home laptop game for me.
Yeah, I think it'll run on pretty much anything. Yeah. It's like recommended hardware specs on Steam as like 3D card or something.
Hell
like
yeah.
That. So it'll run on whatever you got.
Right on. Cool. Thanks, Wes. I've been playing a lot. I play a lot of games, always. Too many games. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each of them because I think we've talked about them over the previous weeks in some detail. But first of all, I've been playing Wolfenstein 2, the new Colossus. Is that what it's called?
So we know the campaign's not as good as Call of Duty's, right? But it's close.
Shut the fuck up. It's pretty great so far. I'm about 7 hours in, and it's very familiar. It's still that same kind of here's an arena in a very cool setting. For the most part, they're cool settings. A lot of industrial corridors that I'm not super into, with commanders that you have to, you know, kill, or otherwise enemies will keep spawning in. And I don't know, that feels largely unchanged from the first game, which is a little disappointing. And I wasn't a huge fan of the gunplay in the first game to begin with, because it's a little like mushier and movement is a little stranger. I feel like there's not a lot of feedback between like what your weapons and like, I don't know, like what they're doing to the Nazis, versus like something like a Doom.
You mean killing them?
Well, it'll dissolve them, but it's also like, I don't feel like this is like great hit indicators for you. I feel like I just dissolve, my health dissolves, and I don't really notice half the time.
Did you find that in the first one too, or yeah, this one even more so?
Maybe more so in this one, because I'm just, I don't know, it's the second time I've played a game like this, and I'm maybe I'm worse at it than before, like less patient, because Doom taught me to be more aggressive. I might be just playing it wrong. Either way, excellent, excellent script. Like the characters, the setting, it has probably one of the biggest, most surprising twists in a first person narrative game that I've experienced in a long time. Like I was talking to Evan about it, and we just call it like, it's just total whiplash. You go from the lowest low to the highest high to the lowest low and then to the highest. It's all within an hour. It's a pretty crazy moment. So it's worth it for little set pieces. The writing is super funny. Everything's over the top, and it's surprisingly good at dealing with heavy topics like domestic abuse and Nazis. And like racism. Yeah, it deals with those topics in pretty tender ways that took me by surprise for such an over the top game, just like the first one, I think. But they explore BJ and his past in surprising detail,
which I'm curious now if any previous Wolfenstein game. So I know id's approach to games was very much like, we don't give a shit about story, it's about like being badass as hell. Yeah. Like that's what video games are. And then I never played the 2009 Wolfenstein, but it's kind of like
Ravens.
But it's kind of like it never occurred to anyone until Machine Games, like, what if BJ Blazkowicz was like a character, like a human being, person with like that you might care about. You know, he was just the ultimate avatar. He was just a face and just a name to put on the box. And then you were just the guy who killed Nazis. And that it's still so striking that in that first game, they were like, what if we still keep this character design of like the ultimate meathead soldier and then just put a ton of pathos into them.
Yeah, and they continue that in super surprising ways this time. Like, I think the game is, it's worth it for its, you know, its over the top violence, and like the whole like alternate future setting is super well realized. But BJ as a character, I think, is one of the best reasons to play that game. Just seeing where that's they really go cool. with him. Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't finish it because it's a pretty buggy game too.
Are you stuck or something?
No, I don't know why, but since I played like 5 hours, 7 hours in one session, and now whenever I boot the game up, the resolution on my computers or my monitors freak out a bit, and the game auto minimizes and then won't open again unless I force close it. I've tried many, many things.
Bummer.
Googled many solutions, none have worked, which is just it's a huge bummer. Even the latest patch and the beta branch haven't helped me out, so we'll see. Maybe I'll finish it someday.
Guess you gotta watch it on YouTube.
I guess we'll see. I really don't want to. Otherwise, I played like 2 hours of Assassin's Creed Origins, which I don't really have a huge take on it yet. It feels very Assassin's Creed-y in that like you're a kind of a mysterious figure. Actually, he's a pretty likable character. Bayek.
Probably not pronouncing that right, but
I'm probably screwing it up.
I haven't played it, so I haven't heard
I have played it, and I still am forgetting. He's actually one of the more likable assassins in recent memory. Like, he feels like a person, and he has a reason for doing the things he's doing that I am behind. I think what stands out most about that game so far is Egypt as a setting is super well realized.
We posted an article on the site on Monday of Assassin's Creed locations. I think it was yesterday, actually, Tuesday, of photos that people had taken. We said, hey, send us your photos from the photo mode because it lets you play with the camera angles and, you know, do filters and stuff. And people sent us some great shots from that environment.
It is so beautiful. It's one of those... Ubisoft is sort of infamous for their open world bloat, and I think it still has some bloat. But the world doesn't feel designed with... you know, supporting specific missions in mind. It feels like it was built to be a natural setting before it was, you know, before anything else.
I mean, that's the payoff of putting in animals and, like, weather systems and stuff, right? Is you can't just make the map like a container for 100, you know, little collectibles and stuff. Like, absolutely. It has to have some cohesiveness to it.
Yeah, since The Witcher 3, I don't think I've seen an outdoor setting as believable. I think Ghost Recon Wildlands had really nice terrain detail, but it wasn't a totally believable setting for other reasons.
Play box.
But this is more than anything, I think I want to play this game to just see the world and just appreciate it. And so I'm really excited for that historical mode, whatever that's called,
it's coming out next year, I think,
something like that. Because I think that'll be like
it's
potentially
like museum mode or something. I forget the exact name.
Potentially really cool. So amazing detail in that world.
Maybe you haven't played enough yet, but the big talking points around this game have been how much inspiration it's taken from other games, right?
Like,
we're gonna take, you know, story and quest ideas from The Witcher, and not necessarily using ripping off their quests, but just making side quests have like narrative significance beyond just like go get 7 coconuts from this tree. Like, that was what was so striking about The Witcher 3, was you just talk to some random villager and like, oh, here's like an intensely written hour-long quest with like character motivation and all this stuff.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like as gripping as that, but The Witcher 3 had a fictional setting to work with. Here, what I've appreciated about the side quests is that they haven't been like go collect these things, and that they, I think, have been trying to teach me about like the culture of ancient Egypt and traditions of ancient Egypt. I don't know the veracity of the things that it is doing, but there like have been side quests where it's, you know, I'm trying to help prepare for a certain like annual ceremony about, you know, worshiping some deity or like honoring some deity and trying to renew the harvest and some things like that.
They wanted it to be legit.
So. Yeah. And I think Assassin's Creed games have always been fairly good at that. And this one seems beyond all others so far, like the most, I don't know. It's the one that's the history of it and like the realism of it and like sort of that the intent to tell or show the place, I mean, as it was, as well as you can within like this dopey assassination action game, is really apparent. So
I just set dressing.
Yeah. I thought I was done with Assassin's Creed, but like this is, I'm totally into it. Real quick, I'll just list off, played a bit of Neo. It's on PC now. And the port is not great. You can go to PCGamer.com and read about that. It's
has a strange brightness slider.
Yeah, it's a janky ass like kind of Koei Tecmo port, and it's functional though. If you are willing to put up with a strange launcher and like no mouse control,
you better have a controller for that one.
Yeah, good game. Otherwise. And I finished the Destiny 2 Leviathan raid with Tim.
Tim's not here. We don't have to talk about this.
We don't. And Mr. Soup, I think he was in the voice chat. One of our community members joined us. And
a couple community members.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And a few of Tim's raid buddies. So that was like a really fun time. Playing it on the PC, we were all lower level than when I had played it on console. And it was easier, partially because I had done it before, but mouse control, I'm telling you what, it like
headshots.
Yeah, it was so much easier to react to everything. But anyway, Anything else?
Awesome.
Is that good? That's all the games we've played.
A lot of games.
We've played, played a lot. A total of six games.
Bo played stuff at BlizzCon.
I did play some stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Can you just roll in? Take us through your journey, Bo.
Yeah.
What happened?
It was your first BlizzCon.
It was my first BlizzCon. It was a lot of fun. I have not been to a lot of game conferences or events other than like GDC before, so it was really cool to kind of go and do one. And Blizzard, BlizzCon was really cool. Like, I obviously, y'all know, I've play a lot of Overwatch.
Yeah. Did you have any games, like heart flutters at just Blizzard stuff everywhere you looked?
A little bit. I mean, I think more than anything was the Reinhardt cinematic that they unveiled, the new...
And that's your boy, too.
Yeah, I mean, I like Reinhardt was my first Overwatch main. I'm now a Zarya main, but I still play a lot of Reinhardt. And I almost teared up during that cinematic. It was so good. It was so heartfelt, and it had like genuine character development in this like 3-minute video that, with, you know, not a ton of dialogue. It was kind of gets into the character development like of that scene, as well as like a ton of good backstory for like who his character is now. I thought it was really great. But yeah, as for actual stuff that I played, big announcements, one of the biggest announcements out of the weekend was the WoW Classic servers for World of Warcraft, which is really, really cool. Steven Mesner had a great feature for us about how they're going to get it done and everything.
And it's not coming soon.
Right. This was basically just the "we're working on it" announcement. And it's I don't know even how far into development they are, but it seems like pretty early stages. Which is, you know, that's one of the big questions is, why is it going to take so long, considering that, like, with the Nostralis private server that was a WoW Classic server that recently got shut down, like, basically a team of not very many people have had this stuff kind of up and running for a while now. And so why is it going to take Blizzard, this massive company, or really, like, with access to the core original stuff, like, why is it going to take them so long to do it? I mean, I guess the answer is just that they have a lot of actual QA to go through, probably, and development to build out the systems.
I think part of it too was they're going to basically rebuild WoW Classic on their like modern server infrastructure, right? So they're not going to recreate the exact like back end conditions that probably could not sustain like the number of people who are going to end up wanting to play this thing. So I think the way it's going to work out is it's going to be, you know, 2006 era WoW running on, or 2007 whatever, running on 2018 era hardware, and so it will probably be a much more robust platform than it was back then, but still play like the old game. I'm wondering if that's going to come out before the next WoW expansion, because I think that's supposed to be next fall. So I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a ways out.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if this ended up coming out, you know, spring 2019 or something.
Yeah, it seemed, based upon the way BlizzCon went, it seems like the expansion would come first, because they were like, we're doing WoW Classic, and that's it. Like, we're working on it. And then they went into their
Battle for Azeroth. All the stuff. And then they like
dumped a huge info dump for the expansion. And it was like, that seems very built out. Like, it was playable, all this stuff. So like the expansion is, at least in terms of development, it seems much closer, unless they're playing their cards extremely close to their chest, which would not be surprising.
No. So as an old WoW player from like the vanilla days, which of those two things was more appealing to you? Because the expansion itself kind of has a throwback vibe.
It does, they both were pretty intriguing. The last time I played WoW was Wrath of the Lich King, which was the second major expansion. It was like level 80. And I played a little bit at 85. What was the one after Wrath?
It's still been like 8 years or something.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a long time, and the game has changed like so much since then. Like, they've both, in terms of there's like multiple new classes, new faction things, like just the sheer amount of content.
There's pandas.
And there's pandas. Yeah. But in addition to that, they also like at least once, if not multiple times, have like overhauled the like talent trees and the systems going on behind. So basically all of the knowledge I used to have about WoW is just like totally useless at this point. And so for a long time, my thought process was just like, if I bring myself, I can't bring myself to go back to WoW because that's so much new information I have to learn. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of like leaving it as a distant memory. So in that regard, the WoW Classic is very appealing because it was a lot of really great stuff. And also because when I started playing WoW, it was still in quote unquote vanilla WoW, but like the first two raids were already out. Like Molten Core and Blackwing Lair were done. And so when I was playing, I actually kind of skipped over, or I didn't get to experience any of the like true vanilla WoW, like of the very beginning of it, like before any of the raids unlocked and stuff.
So you think maybe you'll go in on
maybe,
day one.
Maybe I'll try some of that out and kind of experience. Because to me, the best days of an MMO are the early days when kind of nobody knows what's going on and you're figuring stuff out together, which is weird in this case because everything has already been figured out.
Yeah,
it'll still be like experiencing stuff together for the sort of first time. But yeah, so WoW was cool. The expansion seems really cool. It's like Battle for Azeroth is the name of the next expansion.
It's apparently going to have some like classic Warcraft style like RTS stuff.
Yeah,
it's weird. Explain
they,
that.
They like took, taking inspiration from RTSs, they're like have these, I forgot.
It's for PvP, right?
Yeah, it's for PvP and it's, I forgot what the name, I think they're called Warfronts. I think. And so, yeah, they took the idea of having RTS control and having a PvP map, but then scaling out, or having a PvP battle in WoW, but then scaling it out to a more macro level where you're, you know, building out your bases and building units to send in. But then instead of having like hero units that you would send out, like in an RTS, like that's you. You and your like allies are the hero units that are going into battle with your troops. So I guess it's kind of sort of MOBA like in that regard, but then it also has the RTS elements of like actually building up your base.
That's rad.
So yeah, I didn't get to play any of that mode. It might have been playable, but I was busy doing
you had a lot
stuff.
Going on.
Yeah, I was the only person from the team there.
You,
so
you did about
like,
8 interviews over
yeah,
2 days.
Yeah, I did 8 interviews. Yeah. So yeah, I actually didn't even get, aside from the opening ceremony, I didn't get to go to any panels. I was just in interviews like the entire time. And I saw the Overwatch World Cup, which was pretty cool. But yeah, speaking of Overwatch, there were two pieces of content unveiled. One is a new hero, Moira. She is a support hero, which is a welcome addition to the cast, being the, I believe, 6th support hero, but 5th. Healer, since Symmetra doesn't really count as a healer. And yeah, her kit is pretty weird.
She's very like offense and defense, right? Like she can do both.
She can do both, but like not as much as say Zenyatta or even Anna.
Really?
Her damage is pretty low, but she does have to play offensively because her healing her heal effect it's metered and the meter recharges extremely slow on its own. However, using her right click or alternate fire deals damage, and the damage it does is pretty low. I think it's like 40 DPS, which is less than Winston's cannon. Winston's like primary attack, right, which is already one of the kind of the lowest attacks damages in the game. So it doesn't do very much damage. However, it doing that heals her and recharges the health, the healing.
Okay. So she has like a lot of sustain, it sounds like.
Yeah. It's a matter of, she has to do that damage in order to keep her heals up and to stay active. So she, that creates this kind of like ebb and flow of like, she's a burst healer in that regard. She can put out a ton of healing. It's like, I think it's like 80 heals per second, which is higher than Mercy, and it's an AoE heal.
Oh shit.
Not in a big like wide area, but her heal is basically a stream in front of her. It's sort of like Mei's little frost cannon.
Okay.
But it shoots out this stream about 15 meters in front of her. So it's like a longer range than May's little thing. But any ally in that stream gets hit with the heal. So it's not like Mercy's where she's tethered to one person. It's
right.
If there's two people next to each other, she's going to heal both of them. So that can account for a lot of frontline burst healing. But if she that heal, I think it only will last about 9 seconds if she just holds it down the whole time. So she's got to kind of burst heal and then switch to damaging to recharge that meter and then go back to healing. So it's that balance between the two. And on top of that, her main ability is this biotic orb, which can it like shoots out a big orb that functions physically similar to like Symmetra's orb.
Okay.
or Orisa's halt in terms of like what it looks like.
It bounces, right?
But it bounces off of terrain or walls or ceilings and stuff. And as it passes by, so when you shoot it, you activate it and then you choose either damage or healing. And then depending on which one you pick, it either tethers to allies as it passes and heals them. Or if you choose damage, obviously it attaches to enemies and deals damage. So you can use this E4 in the situations when you need a bit of extra burst healing. You can use the heal orb or go for damage.
Does it pass through shields?
It does.
Okay, gotcha.
It passes through barriers. It is absorbed by defense matrix, and it can, I believe, be deflected by Genji.
Okay.
But yeah, otherwise it passes through Reinhardt's shield, so it can kind of be used to get some poke damage through that area. And then she also has this little, her escape ability is called Fade, and it's kind of like a cross between Blink and it's not quite a teleport. It's like she goes invisible for like a little bit less than a second, and then moves super fast during that time period. So she can just use it and stay still, or you can go and turn, but
it's good for mind games.
Yeah, basically you can be going one direction and then fade and change directions. And you travel pretty far, like you move really, really fast, and for the duration of it, you're like invisible and invulnerable and stuff. So it's a really good escape ability. It's also only on a 6 second cooldown right now. So
that might get elongated.
I have a feeling it'll maybe get dropped down to maybe 7 or 8. It feels pretty, pretty quick at 6. But she's also pretty squishy. I mean, she's a 200 health hero with no armor, no shields, and nothing like that. And the self heal only happens while she's damaging. So, not a ton of sustain in that regard.
So do you see her potentially replacing, you know, a Mercy or an Anna in a lot of team comps?
Yeah, I think she can, like, she has enough healing output that she can be a solo healer or a primary healer, or will be paired with an off healer. So like she's a main healer, she has the healing output to keep a whole team up. I think she'll pair well with Zenyatta because he can kind of attach his orb onto that's the thing, is her healing is all very short range. Because like even Mercy, she has to be close to the people she's healing, but she has a lot of movement to like get around and fly to somebody across the map to get them heals. Whereas Moira, like, yeah, Fade will get you a little bit far, but like she doesn't have a ton of mobility to really go far and get somebody. So she's like a frontline healer that needs to be right up there. She'll be really good at keeping tanks up, basically, as opposed to keeping like your flankers or your DPS up.
Got it.
And then her ult is pretty cool too, though. It's this big, like, basically just beam.
Laser beam.
It's just a giant fat laser beam.
That heals and damages, right?
It does, yeah. It does a ton of healing. I think it's like 200 or 300 health per second. Like, really a lot of healing, you know, up there with Transcendence or whatever. But it also does damage, I think around 70 DPS, so not a ton of damage, but it's enough that, like, it does both, you don't have to pick, and she also moves pretty quickly while using it, so she can move, and it can be, like, retargeted and everything. It's just, like, it's wherever your cursor is pointing, so that'll be useful for, keeping people up through, like, a Graviton combo, but also, I saw a lot of people talking about how it'll probably be used to break through choke points. Because you can basically just like put the beam up and then have your DPS like a Genji it. Or your Reapers just run down the channel of the beam and just be getting that healing put on them, basically turning your DPS into a tank for a minute.
Interesting.
To break through. And especially, you know, if there's like a Reinhardt choke being held down, if you just stick the beam straight down the middle, the defenders are going to have to scatter in order to get out of the way of the damaging beam. They don't want to stand in it. And then your DPS will be able to just run through the middle. So I think she definitely opens up some tactical abilities and will some new strategies. Like that, my biggest takeaway from her is that she, because of the way the heal works, it's a relatively simple heal to use, kind of similar to Mercy. Like it's just point and click at your allies, but still seems like there will be a pretty high skill ceiling for strategy and tactical use. So,
and she's live on the PTR right now.
That's correct.
I don't know if you guys saw it. Evan put out a tweet a day or two ago with a clip from the PTR in a match that was maybe entirely Moira.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it was a play of the game clip of a Moira running into a like capture point and just like seven laser beams and orbs just yeah. flying out. It was just the entire screen was that covered might have even with been... yellow and purple. And I'm not sure if anyone was dying because there was just so much healing going around.
I think that was actually from, it was on PTR, but it was also in a custom game with cooldowns removed. So everybody was also throwing out like orbs like all over the place. It's
a probably exaggerated scenario.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. I think I did see that, but still, yeah, it's the PTR match. That's the thing is like, I played her a bit and I have continued to play with her a bit on PTR. But it's kind of tough to get a beat on how she'll really fall into the meta because like, obviously people are wanting to play with her. So they're playing the no limits modes. You get matches with like at minimum two or three Moiras in a game, if not like all six. And that just doesn't give you a real feeling of what she's going to be like in actual gameplay. So but I think she's a cool hero, and interesting enough design. It's kind of different from what we have so far.
Do we have a word on when she'll be out?
In based upon past heroes on PTR, they've usually been there for 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay,
so
pretty soon.
I would guess probably around the end of the month. In Sweet. November is when I would guess she'll be hitting live.
Anything else from BlizzCon, Bo? Any big notes?
So much other stuff.
Any good cosplay?
Let's see. There was some good cosplay. What was my favorite thing cosplay I saw? I didn't see it while I was there, but a picture that got tweeted out after the fact was there was a big group of Overwatch heroes, but they were all like punk rock Overwatch like heroes.
80s style?
Yeah, more like... Yeah, kind of like 80s, 90s, like grungy punk rock. Like Soldier had this like had an electric guitar, and like there was like a bit of goth, like big,
okay,
like strappy boots and stuff on some of them, ripped jeans and everything. It was.
Did anybody have like the 90s pant, like the giant goth pants?
Jinko.
I have to look at the picture again. Like, I'll see if I can find it.
Just but the like giant pants with the straps.
So many pockets.
Oh, so good.
I don't know, but one thing that I was thinking about with that picture though is like, maybe it's a testament to people making their costumes or to the original character design. But it's like these are outfits that are like pretty different from the original characters' outfits. But I could still like point to as like, that's Mei, that's Symmetra, like that's Soldier. Mm-hmm. Like it's still a very defined like character vision to each of them. So I thought it was pretty cool.
I mean, speaking of that kind of identifiable character vision, there are skins from other game, well, themed skins from other Blizzard games.
This was another big announcement.
Right.
I don't think every hero is getting. I think every hero is getting a new legendary skin, okay. And these are skins that are going to be in just the regular non-event loot boxes.
Yeah, one so you'll just get them.
You'll get them normally. Yeah,
random draw.
Because that was a criticism that Blizzard has been facing recently is that the event skins seem really cool, but like there's hasn't been a lot of incentive to play when you've already unlocked like all of the normal stuff,
except for just liking the game.
Yeah, well, obviously,
who wants to do that
in terms of unlocking stuff? And so, yeah, every hero is getting a new legendary skin, and a handful of them are their skins from other Blizzard properties. So Widowmaker is getting a Nova skin. Roadhog is getting a Butcher skin.
Of course.
What's another one of them? Doomfist is getting like a Blackhand skin.
Nova was the one that really stood out.
Nova was definitely one, because in Heroes of the Storm, for example, Nova has Widowmaker skins. It seemed like a natural fit to do it the other way. And this is actually something that I asked Jeff Kaplan about when I interviewed him a couple months back, right after the Widowmaker Nova skin was announced for HOTS. And his answer at the time was, that's something that we would love to do in the future, but for at least like the first year or so of Overwatch. This conversation happened right at the 1 year anniversary of Overwatch. And he said like, yeah, for the first year of Overwatch, we didn't want to dilute it with other Blizzard universes because we wanted it to establish itself as its own thing.
Makes sense.
First.
Yeah. I don't think they have to worry about that too much.
Yeah. It's pretty well established.
30
now.
Million copies sold or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So now they obviously feel comfortable enough to bring, the other properties in. So
cool.
Yeah.
I'm excited. Well, I want to get that, like a Zerg Kerrigan Widowmaker going on sometime soon.
Yeah.
What were the best and worst things you ate at BlizzCon?
Oh God. Convention food.
I mean, it didn't have to be literally at the convention. It was while you were on the trip.
While I was there, I had a lot of press room meals.
Like a serviceable sandwich with an apple type.
It was at the Anaheim Convention Center, and it was like, it felt like basically catered food, but I mean, catered by the like convention center, in that it was a couple of Sterno trays with food.
Not bad.
Better than your usual convention food.
Yeah. But, unfortunately, based upon my dietary restrictions, I was not able to eat a lot of them. So one of my meals was just white rice.
Hey.
and another was an apple. I had
The apple wins it.
All right.
Cool.
Oh, wait, worst meal. Come on. Best meal, worst meal.
I don't know.
I mean, I like rice too, but an apple versus rice, I think an apple
is a toss up, man.
When you're super hungover from going to BlizzCon parties the night before, and all you want is like a hearty plate of bacon and eggs, and you're given an apple.
That's not going to cut it.
Not a great meal.
No. Oh, poor Bo. Well, you made it and survived.
I did. Got some good
coverage.
It was a lot of fun. There was so much more to come out of that. I had some interviews with like some Blizzard execs, all the different game teams. We talked to StarCraft Remastered and Here's the Storm and all this stuff. So check out PCGamer.com.
A good chunk of that has gone up already?
Yeah, a fair bit of it through the weekend. For all you Hearthstone fans out there, there was a panel that included some rapping from Ben Brode that we will be putting up sometime this week.
You're welcome?
Yeah, you're welcome.
Right on, Bo. Thanks a bunch. So let's move on from character skins and WoW Classic and so on to another classic setting game.
Wow, that transition.
It's not a good one. I tried.
Classic.
The Second World War. It's
World War Classic.
Yes.
I mean, if there's ever been a classic war, it was that one, right?
I suppose an unforgettable one, definitely. I played and reviewed Call of Duty 2. I went to a review event for 2 days at Raven Software in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, which was something else. They've made a lot of cool games.
I mean, you've been in that neck of the woods.
Oh yeah, like they're like
Midwest, more
20
than,
minutes from my aunt's house. She said she would pick me up from the airport and take me to ice cream. Like, so
did she do that?
No, we didn't have time. I'll go to Culver's next time. I played like the entire campaign, 15 hours of multiplayer there, and about 5 hours of zombies. Then I came back, the game came out, and I played, oh God, another 10 hours multiplayer or so, and then a couple hours of zombies. Didn't play any more of the campaign. So I played a lot of this game. The marketing around this game was, I don't know, did you guys get the impression it was overdone? you might say.
You mean the representation of the war, like bombastic?
Yeah, I mean,
I got the impression that boots were going to be on the ground.
Yeah, everyone got that impression. I don't think they even say that in the game once, funny enough.
They sure say it in the marketing.
They sure fucking do.
In interviews all the time.
But I don't know. What are the big questions you guys... Do you guys even care, first of all? But if anything, like, I kind of want to know what you expected or what you thought this game would do in the return to World War II, or what you thought it should do in the return to World War II for the campaign specifically.
Yeah.
Multiplayer is kind of another.
So I went and played a preview of it about a month before the game came out, which was when they were doing the PC beta. Mm-hmm. So I didn't play the campaign. I just got to watch like a kind of their video where they...
Sizzle.
They were like, you know, we went to the real locations and we did this, and it's all about the brotherhood, and you know,
yeah, it is
trying to convey all the emotion and stuff. And then I just ended up playing multiplayer, so I guess I didn't expect too much.
Right.
What I hoped for before I played the multiplayer was something that felt like it broke from the lineage of Modern Warfare, Call of Duty. In terms of like the speed of your movement, the way the guns feel mm-hmm. when you fire them and reload them, and the way the perk system works and the way unlocks work and all, and putting weapon mods on and stuff. And while there are like a few little structural changes there, like I think the most of the past few games have had their pick 10 system where you just like customize your own loadouts, whereas this has like predetermined loadouts,
divisions. Is what they're called.
That's like a very, very minor change to like the structure of how you choose a character, and otherwise the way all of it works is it feels just like a reskinned version of those old games.
Yeah, and I suppose that's like, it's just as much of a criticism as it is praise for me, because I thought the Advanced Warfare and Infinite Warfare multiplayer modes were kind of getting away from what I liked about the multiplayer, which was just sort of all about map knowledge, because you have to know these maps. You have to know where at any point anyone could be looking at you, peeking out from a window or around a corner, and anticipate that based on minor tactical information like your radar, or you know, you might have a perk or something that helps you out, or just sound design, and reacting before the other person more accurately, like a very simple, almost like arena shooter on the back of meat bags, you know, clumsy meat bags.
I don't know exactly how to describe for me like the delineation between arena shooter and Call of Duty style shooter in terms of what's satisfying from them. But for me, like a game like Unreal, where you come around a corner and there's an enemy there and you got to kill them real fast or you're dead, is really physically satisfying to play. And like, I like the skill ceiling there and, you know, how quickly somebody can get destroyed, versus in Call of Duty, I've just had enough and never really want to play again this exact formula of like every gun pretty much shoots high velocity, you know, maybe there's like a couple bolt actions or something you're gonna unlock, but for the most part it's like two or three bullets is gonna kill somebody, you come around a corner, it's just like who pulls the trigger faster and then who can mash the respawn button, you know, you're just like in this,
it's,
you get in this loop of like lives that you throw away because you're respawning instantly after you die. Deaths come so quickly, you know, respawning health isn't a mechanic. And like, I don't know exactly what the difference between the two of those things is, but I find one much more satisfying than the other.
I would agree. And I don't think World War II changes that or tries for more. It really tries, it's in my view, it tries to just take it back to Modern Warfare. Mm-hmm. And for some people, that will be great. For a lot.
I don't think it takes it back to Call of Duty 2. It takes it back to Modern Warfare.
Modern Warfare, for sure. Call of Duty 2 was pre-hit indicator and progression and like all that. I mean, some of that was there, but not overblown in the way that it became in Modern Warfare. And you know, score streaks and such, they're all there. I think it's kind of hard to say I don't know. That's my criticism of it in the review, is that it feels good. It feels like it used to when that was a novel thing and Modern Warfare came out, and it, I don't know, it felt like an iteration on shooters that we, you know, a take on shooters that we really hadn't seen, somewhere straddling, like I said, arena shooting plus, you know, light tactical team play if you want, plus this kind of like really short time to kill. It felt very novel, and it's kind of, you know, for a while there felt very unique, and then over 10 years.
There's been, what, 9 iterations?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That are so, using that exact same formula.
Yeah, it's lost that kind of punch, but it's still, you know, it's a cozy pair of slippers. And the levels are kind of like simplified and smaller, and I like the 3-lane structure of most of them. You can kind of hop into a level, and at least if you've never played it before, a map, and kind of anticipate, like, what to do and what's going on and like where to go, and it's pretty readable in that way, and it gets rid of like the mobility stuff that came in the later games that I think kind of blurred the whole, I don't know, I hate to say purity, but we talk about purity a lot in arena shooters too, you know, like it almost made it like you had character abilities and such that that dissolved the hard skill ceiling. So I don't really have a lot to say about the multiplayer. It's good, and I've enjoyed playing it. The war mode is like I think you wrote about in your preview. It's just like a nice, it's fine. It's not the pinnacle of like team-based objective play, but it's an interesting, it's a new mode for people to yell at each other about playing the objective about.
It's asymmetrical, so you have one team on offense, one on defense, and you're trying to like push forward through a series of objectives.
Yeah, and there's some pretty cool, like, I don't know, one, you're on a beach, and it's kind of it's honestly like thematically a little problematic to me, but it's still novel and interesting from, you know, how you play it. You start on a beach and you have to like run up Normandy style while people, the enemy team of actual people, can mount turrets and try and shoot you down. And they try and take your bunkers and then move inward to another series of bunkers with AA guns that, you know, there are like tiny reinforcements each team can build or tear down. And team play is very important, you know, communicating. So that's like new for Call of Duty. And there's KD isn't even like measured in those matches or modes. So
that's cool.
That's good.
I appreciate them trying to do something different there. Yeah.
But it's not gonna like, I think this will be a Call of Duty multiplayer that, maybe has an audience on PC for, well, cause there was like almost no audience for Infinite Warfare last year. This one seems to have carved out something, or at least has early indications of carving out something, which I'm happy about. I like that series overall, and I, you know, I'm happy to keep it around so long as people want to play it, and so long as it doesn't, you know, suck.
What do you think about that multiplayer versus Battlefield 1?
It's you know, it's totally different. Vehicles in Battlefield 1, the scale of those maps.
I guess I just mean in terms of deliberately choosing a more antiquated setting and how that affects the weaponry and the style of combat versus other games in the series.
I mean, that's a good question, because Battlefield 1, I think, completely benefits from the antiquated setting, because it takes into account how junky its weapons are. I mean, it's not a sim. It's not like you're playing Arma.
Yeah, like, but you're still using some pretty badass machine guns for the, you know, being 1920.
Yeah, but in Battlefield 1, you're not getting, like, red dot sights, and you're not getting, you know, mods that necessarily make them just perfectly accurate killing machines. They are, some are slow and like have just wacky recoil and, you know, are effective at certain ranges. Some of those bolt actions take a long time to reload. In Call of Duty World War II, the weapons are significantly more efficient than they ever would have been back then. They pretty much play like they would in Modern Warfare. And you get mods and scopes and such that essentially make them as efficient as any fucking future assault rifle. Like, the line there, it feels like a theme more than anything. A new coat of paint, you might say.
An old coat.
An old coat of new paint. A new coat of old paint.
It's rusty paint.
It's rusty-ass paint. And I think, I don't know that, I think Call of Duty World War II could benefit from junking up its weapons a bit, really kind of, because I still get frustrated with how easily I get no-scoped across the map and yada yada. But that's sort of a signature feel at this point. I think it would be upsetting to a lot of the established player base, maybe, or at least maybe it wouldn't, but I don't know if Activision is just too scared to...
That's clearly what they decided.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it, you know, good multiplayer mode. Campaign is just drab. Boring. See,
that was one of my big questions about the game, is not being a big Call of Duty fan and not really having played a ton of these games.
Yeah.
But knowing that the, basically for like you and me, this is returning to World War II, where there used to be a lot of World War II shooters. But there are a lot of gamers out there who didn't have those games, the like the PS2 era,
yeah,
World War II shooters the first time around. And so my big question is kind of like, how does it, I mean, I think this was part of the marketing of, not marketing of the game, but the thought process of the game, is they were like, this is going to be the World War II shooter for this next generation. And basically, does it hold up, maybe not in comparison to the old ones, but like as a fresh entry point, like is it worth playing for a new audience?
Does it accomplish their stated goal of preventing World War III?
Fuck no. Fuck no. To both those questions, I would say, to Wes's question, fuck no. To Bo's, not at all. There, I don't know. First of all, I think its biggest crime is just, and maybe, I don't know, I have to go back and play some the old World War games, but it gives you almost no context for what you're doing. Mm. And I think for a lot of people playing this game for the first time, a lot of younger people especially, they may not be totally up to snuff on the history. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe I've gotten older and I feel more strongly about these things than I did as a teen. Well, I definitely do. Is I think there's a responsibility to at least provide, you know, the historical context for a big dumb entertainment thing portraying or attempting mm-hmm. to portray one of the biggest catastrophes in, you know, recent history. And instead what we get is it fucking opens up and it's like you get a maybe, I don't know, minute long sort of like bullet point recap of what World War II is, not like why it's being fought or, you know, who is fighting it or what has happened in the war, such as like, you know, the you know, genocide perhaps. Mm-hmm. None of that stuff is really, really underlined. You start in Normandy and you kind of make your way up to the Western Front to the Battle of the Bulge, and throughout your only real reference point for what's going on are these characters, which are like good old American corn-fed boys from Texas who, you know, miss their pregnant wives. And you have an angry CO who just is on the verge of an alcoholic breakdown. And you have the nerdy guy with thick-rimmed glasses who's taking photos.
Is his name Radio?
I don't even fucking remember. They all have names like Daniels and Bradley and, you know, yeah, maybe accurate to the era, but like just utterly forgettable because there's just so little time dedicated to giving them space to like exhibit who they are besides yelling at each other in battle, get down, Nazis, yada, yada. And, beyond that, it's hard to care about them or like what they're doing because you don't know why they're doing it. There are a few times, I don't expect like this to be a complete history of World War II, but even in like the between the menus and load times, it just says we're going to fight here now. Okay, we got to take this from the Nazis. Why? Because they're there. Okay, I guess we'll do that. Yeah, and I don't know. It tries really hard to sort of drive home a message of brotherhood and companionship and like friendship and, you know, trusting in one another.
The most generic platitudes possible for a war game.
Yeah, yeah, and it doesn't do it nearly as well as, you know, Band of Brothers or, you know, other World War II media.
That's fair.
Doesn't even approach that, you know, even like the mediocre efforts.
And I think that's one reason why people appreciate stuff like some of the Metal Gear games, yeah. where of course they're not like accurate, realistic history. They're batshit crazy.
Yeah.
But like Metal Gear 3, the story, which is completely fiction, I think has more to say about like the Cold War and nuclear weapons than probably any Call of Duty game has to say, had to say about the real war it was
Absolutely.
Based on. Obviously the, you know, Infinite Warfare is not a real war, unless it's extremely prescient.
Maybe.
Jon Snow goes to space. to fight aliens? What is he fighting?
I don't even know. But I think that's a good point, Wes, because playing this next to Wolfenstein 2 has really, I don't know, it's amazing within Wolfenstein 2's first hour, even though it deals with an alternate ending to World War II, and it's just wacky and over the top and based on, you know, B.J. Blazkowicz. It's amazing within the first hour how much more it has to say about masculinity, about the war, about, you know, just one guy and his origins and, you know, why he is the way he is. Racism, there's even, you know, sexism. It hits them all, and it doesn't feel like a checkbox, like we got to cover these social issues. It feels natural. Whereas Call of Duty is just like, we're bros now because we got to do this because
got to do our duty.
We got to kill the bad guys and sacrifice. And I don't know why I have a pregnant wife at home, but she would want me to die here. I don't know. Like, that's like the message I got from it. And that's pretty reductive, but I mean, beyond that, it also, like, I don't know, the level design is still very, it feels like a direct sequel to Call of Duty 2 in a lot of ways. Just, you're planting explosives on, AA emplacements and, marching through trenches against like an ever, populating wave of enemies that you need to punch through. And there's one mission or two missions in there that are pretty memorable. And I wrote about one on the website today.
Yeah, you wrote about a really cool mission, which it sounds good enough to make you be like, why is the person who designed this mission or the team that designed this mission not getting to do more creative stuff?
They should be in charge of the entire series as far as I'm concerned. But so read about that. There are some redeeming things about it, but otherwise just a very kind of par for the course Call of Duty so far.
All right.
Not awful, but not the best. And with that our duty done called, we're going to open it up to Q&A. I don't think since we're live we're live only in the club. We're just going to go off the questions I have here, and we're kind of running low on time, so I think we'll be able to fill it with the questions you guys gave me already. But those of you in the Discord still listening, add us with some questions if you got them in Ask PC Gamer channel. For those of you who don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, you can head to club.pcgamer.com to find out more about our subscription service, which it gives you a lot of cool stuff, access to our Discord, which is, I don't know, it's like, it feels like the lifeblood of my job now. I just love those guys. We play Destiny 2 all the time now, and I'm in there chatting and making jokes with these fools all the time. But, you know, you also get an ad-free experience on the site. You get a digital subscription to our magazine. You get the RPG handbook, a digital version of that for free. You get, gosh, what am I missing, guys?
You get Tub Geralt.
you get a glossy JPEG.
In 4K.
Of Tub Geralt in 4K. You get a free game each
really
month.
The most important.
It is the most important. There's a lot of cool stuff. That's again club.pcgamer.com. But
we'll have to add Mozu to that.
Oh shit. Like. The Mozu artwork?
Yeah.
We got some good ass Mozu artwork now. And we are actually running a contest, so head to pcgamer.com and like I think you should be on the front page still. If not, you might have to scroll down a bit. Evan commissioned some art of Mozu, Tim's
it is orc fabulous.
Yeah, and if you make some Mozu propaganda, there's a chance to win like a $75 Steam card, I believe. And we've been getting some good shit so far, so I'm excited to see the end result. But on to questions. Buttface Jones, per usual, has one for us, and I like this one a lot. PCG once called Team Fortress 2 the most fun you can have online, a quote that is still prominently displayed on the game's website. What modern game deserves that superlative, if any, and why?
Dang.
Yeah. Yeah. Question. It's a pretty heavy, heavy one.
Twitter.com.
Oh, God.
No, Wes.
Just kidding.
No, Wes.
It's
no.
The least fun you can have online.
I don't know. Like, I feel like PC gaming for me has, like, since fragmented, and there's no, like, big, like, one game you can point to and say, this is the most fun you can have. Because there are many different kinds of fun you can have nowadays. For me, right now, what I would say, and this is going to be very predictable, is in Destiny 2's infancy, it's a lot of fun with people.
Uh-huh.
And you can hang out with me.
That's the most fun you can have online.
Yeah. Right now, if you're me and you want to hang out with me. What? This doesn't make any sense.
You don't want to hang out with yourself.
I don't. That's
guaranteed.
Like, no. What about you guys? Any?
I mean, yeah. Steampower.com?
Steampower.com.
Let's just move it up a peg from TF2 to the Steam portal.
I mean, I think the answer is just playing a game with friends and, you know, developing a community, you know, having a good time.
I mean, so I haven't even played it, but like PUBG seems like kind of this year's water cooler.
You know, for like sure.
If you're going to hang out with a group, you want to be playing the thing that is generating like the wildest stories, experiences that are most widely shareable with other people in your hobby. I think that's the place to go.
Right on. That's a good answer.
Or the PC Gamer Discord Club.
I was going to say Discord is actually a good answer because
Discord.gg/PC Gamer.
I think so. Yeah. Think
that's our permanent link.
But Discord is just like it can make any game a good time easily. Teardog. Teardog was kicking my ass last Friday during our community play hour in Rocket League, and I'll never forgive him, but I'll ask his question anyway. What are the thoughts of PCG on the partnership between Intel and AMD on the CPU/GPU combo for laptops and low-powered desktops? So I'm not, like, super tech-savvy. Well, I'm not up to date on all the hardware news and politics, but do you guys have any thoughts on this? It's pretty surprising, even from the outside looking in. Intel and AMD joining forces. What does it mean?
Yeah, it's definitely surprising. It's pretty cool from a, you know, advancement of technology standpoint.
Yeah.
We have a good piece up on our site from yesterday between Twan and Jared.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, our super hardware experts, even more so than Wes and myself, really going into kind of what this means. But the short version is that it will hopefully, I guess, lower the difficulty of making. Actually, let me rephrase that. I think it'll have its most impact in, I guess, maybe like the Ultrabook space. Mm-hmm. They're looking for being able to make laptops with that are basically that can ship without discrete graphics, but still be, you know, serviceable for playing games. So that hopefully will lead to even thinner and lighter laptops that will not quite be classified as gaming laptops, like in terms of the power of replacing a desktop or being on par with maybe a low powered desktop or something, but that can play a lot of games. And that's getting more and more possible with, you know, you might not be playing the latest AAA games on ultra 60 FPS or whatever. But there are a lot of games from even just a couple of years ago or even easier to play are indie experiences that you know, are very low graphically intensive. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, for the past probably 7 years, something like that, there's been this, I think Intel and AMD have kind of stayed on a course of Intel making better, faster CPUs with pretty bad integrated graphics. Like, obviously, they're getting better at it every year, mm-hmm. But had never caught up to AMD on that front. And AMD making CPUs that likewise have gotten better over time, as you would expect, but still haven't really been able to beat Intel, but have done much better with the integrated graphics. So pairing the two of them is like, it's like the ultimate game facts, like message board thing where it's like, well, obviously the best thing they should do is just put them together. But the realities of global multi-billion dollar businesses is that that would never happen. And yeah.
then they did.
And now they're doing it. So
it's pretty cool.
It seems like really good news for AMD to me more than Intel. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Of course, we don't know like how the money is breaking down and who's, you know, going to really stand a benefit there. But I feel like it's great for users because they're going to get a good Intel CPU with better graphics than they would have gotten otherwise. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this gives AMD, you know, an alternative to companies that weren't using their laptop CPUs because, you know, on the CPU front, Intel was going to be better, or Intel just had made deals with them, or, you know, whatever business decisions. Hopefully it means that their graphics can get into more of the systems and that benefits users. And it just seems like a match made in heaven all around. Mm-hmm. We'll see how it goes, but it's really exciting.
Right on. Moving on.
And maybe NVIDIA's sweating a little bit.
A little bit. I mean, that's good.
I think that's maybe good. A little bit, but also, you know, not to stay on this topic too long, but the thing is NVIDIA really has the market cornered on the, like, discrete graphics, the high-end cards. And this partnership has, like, nothing to do with desktops, at least right now, as far as I understand. Yeah. So,
but even in laptops, they have all the dedicated.
Yeah. Right, cards, yeah. They're not the only place, like, NVIDIA isn't the only people making GPUs, but sometimes it feels like it.
Cool. Moving on, Pierre Fouquet asks, have you ever played a game that you loved but couldn't keep playing because the UI was so bad?
I believe that's pronounced fuck it.
Fuck it. Pierre fuck it. Thanks
game
for the question.
The UI was so bad.
I recall, God.
I definitely have an example, but I can't think of it.
Yeah, it's nothing's coming to mind, but I can remember some garish-ass UI in my time. I want to say, more recently, I really hate the Evil Within 2's UI. It's not very elegant. It's just kind of this garish, just in the corner, very, very plain presentation with like a sort of a scribbly comic book gun. And your health is like a circle. It's definitely, I think it's intentionally a throwback, but I mean, just pare it down a little bit, like give it some opacity, like keep it out of my eyes so you can scare me more often, more easily. But I don't think I've ever run into anything like just offensive.
I found the Xbox One's launch UI offensive.
It was really bad. It was really fucking bad. Awful.
I feel like I should have a good answer for this if I'm drawing a blank.
It's all good. Well, we can move on to another question.
My answer, this is pre-PC days for me, but the I forget which specifically one, but it was one of the Phantasy Star games. I think like Phantasy Star Online, the GameCube version is the one that I played.
Oh.
And it was, I think, like a port of a port or something. And the the UI was just terrible. I think it was like trying to do MMO stuff, but you didn't have a keyboard.
That wasn't because it was a port. That was just Phantasy Star Online.
it was real bad though. I mean, I played a fair bit of it, but then like just attempting to do anything UI wise or attempting to communicate was like impossible.
I played a chunk of Phantasy Star Online this year for a feature I wrote, and it is completely baffling. Yeah, it's just nonsense control scheme. Yeah. That's a good answer.
Good answer. Let's move on to... Can you go back down to that, Wes? Yeah. Kootness asks, anyone from PCG going to Day of the Devs this Saturday? Games there the staff is most looking forward to? So Day of the Devs is Double Fine's sort of annual event where they host just a ton of indie games in this warehouse in San Francisco, and people... It's open to the public. So anyone can go play them. It's pretty cool. I'm going. I think Evan is going, and we might have some freelancer going.
I know one game you're excited about.
Yeah, this year there's a shitload of stuff we have not seen before. It is very surprising, and took us a bit by surprise when we were looking at the list. But
you're like 75 games that are going to be there or something.
Well, that's the thing about Day of the Devs is there's always like 70 some games there. But the thing is most of them usually have already been playable at like a PAX or a GDC or something. So it's kind of rare for there to be the first publicly playable demo of a game to be at Day of the Devs, but it seems like there's more than usual this
year. A good chunk, and a good chunk that have not been widely playable, even if they have been before. But first and foremost, I'm sprinting. I'm sprinting to Untitled Goose Game. You guys know what this is?
I do.
Are you sure you're not waddling to Untitled Goose
Game? I will waddle as fast as my goose legs can take me.
The big, big, biggest question I have about this game is... is the official title Untitled Goose Game, or is that the placeholder title?
I think that should roll with it.
I bet they'll be very coy about that answer.
I mean, I really want the final title to be Untitled Goose Game.
It would be good.
I feel like it's a really good name.
So if you don't know about it, it's literally a game where you play as a goose and try to fuck up a farmer's garden without him noticing. It's a stealth goose game. It looks very cool and
dumb. Metal Goose Solid.
Metal Goose Solid. I'm very curious to play that. I also want to check out Session. I've played it before, but it's a skateboarding simulator, skateboarding lifestyle simulator, is sort of what they're calling it, or culture or something. It's coming from Creature Studios out of Montreal. I've been talking to these guys and following them for like a year now because I've been so excited about this. They have a really cool control scheme. It's going for something a little more technical than Skate series by EA. They have a Kickstarter happening later this month, I think, but their playable alpha is like looking pretty good.
Can you just like wear Vans and then go to school and talk to people about skating, but never
and
skate?
Look bored and uninterested?
Yeah,
I hope so. I hope so.
Isn't that just like Persona?
Basically, man. Oh my God. Can you imagine a Persona skateboarding game?
Yes, I can.
Like, oh shit. Anyway.
I can imagine Teddy on a skateboard.
I would love that shit. There was like a Metal Gear Solid skateboarding game or spinoff or something, wasn't there?
That was on the Xbox version of Metal Gear
Solid
2.
That's right.
I think it was like a mini game.
God, that existed.
That was a weird one. Weird thing.
There's like one called, it's got this amazing look. Look it up. I think it's called Genesis Noir. And I think it's like just genesisnoir.com. And it's billed as like a galactic cosmic noir story between gods. And it's got this like line drawn look that sort of morphs with the camera. And it's hard to describe. Check out the trailer. I don't know how it'll play, but it looks like a sort of a Kentucky Route Zero point and click sort of. Maybe you're not solving puzzles, but you're just interacting with very pretty stuff and getting some good writing at you. There's probably about a dozen other games I want to see there, and people I want to talk to. It's going to be busy.
You're going to be busy.
Yeah. But that's about all the time we have today. Again, thanks for chilling with us in our audio only version of the podcast.
Hopefully the stream will work next week.
we'll get a solution set up and hopefully maybe a backup solution or two sometime soon. But in the meantime, if you're listening to us elsewhere on iTunes or youtube.com/PCGamer or wherever else, you can always check us. Typically, you can hang with us live at twitch.tv/PCGamer. If not, we'll host it in the Discord, and you can join that by going to club.pcgamer.com. So until then, we'll talk to you later.